Hello and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. I'm Peter Beinart, non-resident fellow at FMAP. Today is April 25th, 2024, and I'm delighted to be here with Seth Binder, Director of Advocacy at the Middle East Democracy Center, a merger between the Project on Middle East Democracy and Freedom Initiative. He's an expert in, among other things, arms sales, authoritarianism, human rights, national security, security assistance, and U.S. foreign aid and foreign policy. Seth, thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask a bit about U.S. military aid to Israel and the new debate that's been breaking up about conditioning it. So maybe we can just start by, maybe you could just get an overview of how much military aid does the United States give to Israel every year, and how does the U.S. give it?
Yeah, thank you, Peter, and thanks for having me here. This is a big question. I'll try to be concise. So I think, you know, since World War II, Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid. It's not even close. In any given year, they're almost always the largest recipient in a specific year, outside of maybe rare examples like currently Ukraine's receiving more during the height of the Afghanistan war. Afghanistan was receiving more in a specific year. But over the long trend, Israel's the largest recipient. Currently, in the current Memorandum of Understanding, they're receiving $3.8 billion every year. That runs through 2028. $3.3 billion is coming through an account funded by the State Department called Foreign Military Financing. That's your typical equipment and other missiles and things like that. And then there is $500 million that is paid for from the Defense Department account, which is missile defense, Iron Dome, David Sling, and things like that. As I mentioned, you have the Memorandum of Understanding. But in addition to all of the money, the equipment,
sorry,
and everything
what's the Memorandum of Understanding, just for people who are not familiar with it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Sorry. So since about 1999, the U.S. has signed agreements, administrations with the Israeli government to commit to, and they've typically been about 10 years. This understanding is a 10-year one, as I mentioned, runs through 2028. And it commits the U.S. to provide this $3.8 billion every year. It's not binding legally, so Congress still has to appropriate the funds. But this is sort of the basis of why the U.S. is providing military aid to Israel.
Got it. So the president and the United States and Israel agree that over the next 10 years, the U.S. is going to give Israel X amount of money per year. And then Congress goes ahead and budgets for that amount of money each successive year.
Correct. And then I would add, on top of the specific funds, Israel gets an immense number of privileges, many of which no other country gets. And so you have a thing called cash flow financing that allows Israel to commit future year funds, money that has not even been appropriated from Congress, to buy U.S. arms. They are allowed, written into the law, is immediately the money once appropriated goes into an interest-bearing Federal Reserve account. So the money sits in this account and actually gains interest. So in addition to the $3.8 billion, if money sits there, it's gaining interest, they can use even more to buy arms. They're allowed to use what's called offshore procurement, and that allows them to take a percentage of the money that Congress appropriates and use it on its own defense industry. This is something that no other country is allowed to do. And there's, again, another example is qualitative military edge. And this is enshrined in law and guarantees that even if the U.S. is selling or providing arms to other countries in the region, we commit to make sure that Israel has the best equipment and is able to defend themselves against anyone in the region. And then maybe lastly, another one I would mention, because it's relevant to the current war, is the emergency war stockpile that is stationed in Israel. And this is billions of dollars worth of U.S. equipment that sits there. And then in times of crisis, Israel can quickly access this and use it, something they have done since October 7th.
But there have also been these emergency supplementals in which the US has been, the Congress has been appropriating more. So what's the relation between those emergency supplementals and the kind of annual amount that that Israel is given by the US?
Yeah, there's been a few examples of this. So in 2014, 2021, or most recently, just the other day, in times of major conflict, Congress has jumped in, often at the president's request, to provide additional funds on top of already the annual $3.8 billion. And so in 2021, it was $1 billion in additional funds for Iron Dome interceptors. And we just saw passage of $14.1 billion in unprecedented and unconditioned funds to Israel.
So is that money, like that 14.1 billion, is that similar to the regular aid in the sense that it's basically like a credit card in which Israel is given this money that then they can go use to shop for American weapons?
By and large, yes. Like the typical annual allotment, a portion of that is allowed to be used for offshore procurement for Israel's defense industry. And in actuality, the Biden administration, in its request, asked for all of the FMF, $3.5 billion as a part of this $14.1 billion, to be allowed to be used for offshore procurement. Congress tightened that a little bit to match the current year, so about $700 million. But it has a huge loophole in there that if the administration and Israel agree, they could actually use all of the $3.5 billion for offshore procurement. So it
Meaning buying.
doesn't necessarily mean it would have to go to the U.S. defense industry.
Right. And so just by contrast, can you give me a sense of let's with other countries that the US gives military aid to? I don't know, just how does the process work differently for other countries that the US gives military aid to?
The second largest recipient over many years is Egypt. And in Egypt, it's the annual appropriations process, $1.3 billion in foreign military financing. And it's pretty just sort of cut and dry. None of these extra benefits associated with it. And most other countries operate in this way. They get a portion of money, and then that money is able to be used to purchase US defense equipment, and they have to have all of that money up front to be able to pay for the equipment.
Right. And they can't use it to buy their own weapons. It all has to be spent on American weapons.
Correct. And they can't use it. They can't commit future funds that aren't already appropriated to buy weapons. And so the F-35 is a big contract that Israel signed as an example. And they basically committed years into the future to use future military aid to pay for it.
Even though that aid hasn't actually been appropriated by Congress yet.
Correct. Yeah.
So there's something called the Leahy Law, which, as I understand it, suggests that the US can't give military assistance to any country that has a unit of that military. It can't give money to the unit of a foreign military that has been considered to committing human rights abuses. Can you just talk about the Leahy Law, what it says?
You're basically right. So the Leahy Law prohibits any unit in a foreign military, foreign security forces from receiving U.S. assistance if they've committed or if there's credible allegation that they've committed a gross violation of human rights. You know, this could be rape, murder, all sorts of big, broad things we would think about in terms of the potential human rights violations. And maybe I should add that this specific law applies to anyone, anywhere in the world. It actually it derives from a bigger, broader law called Section 502B of the Foreign Assistance Act. That law says if there's a consistent pattern of human rights violations in a foreign country, that the US cannot provide assistance at all, period. That's it. That law has basically never been enforced, always ignored. And so Senator Leahy, who has the law named after him, tried to narrow down the scope. So rather than focusing on an entire country, let's just target the units we know are committing abuses and not provide them with US assistance.
So with other countries, how does this work? Does the US then go, let's say, I don't know, Colombia or Egypt or Ethiopia or some, how does the US track gather the data to know whether some particular military unit is committing is accused of committing human rights abuses?
For most countries, as they're going through the process of using US assistance or and trying to acquire US weaponry, they have to provide a list of the units that are going to be receiving the assistance. And then those units get vetted by the State Department. And if that unit was found to have committed a gross human rights violation, they'd be denied to receive it. There are a few countries like Israel that receive so much assistance that it's unable, the State Department is unable to know exactly what unit is going to be using that assistance. So imagine it's like thousands of missiles that are transferred from the US to Israel. They go into a warehouse. Israel's not able to say, oh, these 10 units are going to be receiving it. And so they can't vet. And for the longest time, that just meant there was no vetting done at all. In the last year or two, they've changed the process, and Israel's agreed to this, where they have to allow the State Department to vet all units of the Israeli security forces. And then the United States provides a list saying these units cannot receive any assistance coming from us.
And has the United States specified any Israeli military units that cannot receive US military assistance?
As far as is publicly known, no. There's been rumors just in the last week that maybe one specific unit may be receiving a prohibition on assistance. But this is how it would work, the process I sort of just described. The US would send a notice to the Israeli government saying that any equipment you all are receiving, this unit can no longer receive it. They can't receive US training and so forth.
Right. This is the Netzeh Yehuda unit, a unit made up of ultra-Orthodox Israeli Jews. And how significant, if the Biden administration does go ahead with this, has been reported, how significant is this? It sounds like it would be the first time the U.S. has done this. On the other hand, I don't know how you would actually, how could the U.S. actually make sure, as you say, if you're giving thousands of missiles and millions of bullets or whatever, that they're not being used by this particular unit, or that the money could just be fungible and you'd basically just have, the Israel give its own money to this unit and use the US weapons for another unit.
Yeah, that's a great question. Obviously, it would be a welcome decision. Taking this first step is important, but it's far from adequate. I don't think, based on evidence presented by rights groups and others, that this unit is particularly unique. And so, hopefully, this sort of opens the door. But it more much more obviously needs to be done given the evidence that's out there. I think your question around how do you enforce this is the real kicker, though. This is the real challenge. Once the United States were to provide a prohibition on any particular units, how are they going to actually determine or make sure that any weapon that the US is providing is not used by that unit? That sort of system, to the best of my knowledge, is not in place and does not exist. And I think would be a real challenge, in the example of Israel, but honestly, for other countries that this, situation falls in.
There have also been some reports about sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on particular some settlers in the West Bank. So can you talk about kind of how that process works? Is that connected to military aid, or is that something separate?
That's something separate. It's a different State Department process, different law that regulates all of that. I think there's implications for the security services down the line in terms of if a specific unit was to be working with said individuals who have been sanctioned, but it's a separate process.
Right. So it sounds like from what you're suggesting, if I'm hearing you right, that if the US were to actually really just go look at Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, other human rights organizations, or even Israeli ones, and go through and look at what was being done by the Israeli military in terms of what was considered credible human rights abuses by human rights organizations, especially in the wake of the war in Gaza, it would actually start, if we took that seriously, it would actually become kind of tough for the US to give any military aid to Israel. Or is that, is that too much of an overstatement?
Potentially, certain laws specify certain things of what could or could not go. One that's been hotly debated lately is Section 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act, and this one is one that prevents military assistance to any government that is prohibiting or restricting US humanitarian assistance. And so in Gaza, this has been particularly relevant. Members of Congress have raised concerns around this law. But in this case, the way the law is written, things like missile defense, Iron Dome, and other things would not be restricted and could still continue to be provided. In the case of 502B or the Leahy Law, or some of these others, there is an ability for the US to take action to try to hold units who are committing violations accountable and yet not cut off all assistance entirely.
How much support is there in Congress right now for some form of conditioning military aid to Israel?
I think it's growing. Before October 7th, Bernie Sanders was pretty much on his own when it came to this. I think now, this is absolutely something that more and more, especially Democratic members of Congress, are clamoring for. And I think feel is important. Senator Van Hollen introduced an amendment that was supposed, he wanted to include in this supplemental that just passed. It didn't happen, but was turned into a national security memorandum by President Biden.
What does that mean?
So the president took this amendment that was proposed and he basically made it US policy. It's not a law itself because it hasn't gone through Congress, but it has the enforcement mechanism of law. And this specific memorandum was basically requiring that any government receiving US assistance had to provide specific assurances. So, in the case of Israel, they had to provide an assurance that they would abide by international humanitarian law and that they would abide by Section 620I that I just mentioned in terms of not restricting humanitarian aid. Those assurances have now been received by Israel. And the next sort of big deadline is May 8th, where the administration needs to provide a report to Congress on the credibility of those assurances, which many groups have already brought into question.
If you look at the history of the U.S.-Israel relationship, are there precedents for the U.S. restricting military aid to Israel, in the, in previous decades?
On occasion, they have. I think one of the ones that I'm aware of is, and Peter, you might actually know some of these better than me even, but President Reagan in '83 held back on providing some F-16s while Israel was carrying out a war in Lebanon. That's one example I know. There's a few others where there's been sort of conditionality or restrictions at various times. In recent memory, though, no.
Interesting. I guess my last question is, what would you say to folks? There's often, when it comes to debates about Israel, this question of double standards. So what would you say to folks who say that this conditioning of aid to Israel would constitute a double standard, holding Israel to a standard that the US doesn't hold other countries to?
I think it's the opposite. I think the double standard is Israel by like far gets privileges that no one else gets treated to, even if we look at the Leahy Law or we look at other things, nothing like other countries are treated both by administrations and in Congress. You know, I mentioned Egypt. Egypt has a robust conditionality on military aid that's provided every year. It's been in place for over a decade. It creates a natural point of pressure where the Congress and administration are pressure, you know, pressing the Egyptian government. Nothing like that exists for Israel. Even in the heat of this war that's been going on for months now, Congress just passed $14 billion in military aid with zero conditions on any of it, despite all of the credible reports of violations, and yet nothing. We've not seen President Biden, outside of sort of hinting at maybe conditionality, we've not seen him take any real steps. I think, you know, while it's good to prohibit a specific unit with the Leahy Law or some of the settler sanctions that have been put in place, those are, you know, mostly have to do with the West Bank and nothing to do with the war in Gaza. And so, yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the holistic picture, it's actually the opposite, where Israel gets all the benefits and none of the real kind of scrutiny that most other countries receive.
Thanks, Seth. This is really informative. Thanks for joining me. Thanks to our listeners for tuning into this episode of Occupied Thoughts. Please make sure to check out the FMAP website, fmap.org, for resources related to this podcast and lots of other rich content related to Palestine and Israel. And please make sure you're subscribed to this podcast to stay up to date. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Spotify. You can also watch video versions of our podcast, including this one on YouTube. And with that, I'm Peter Beinart signing off until the next episode of Occupied Thoughts.